You're listening to the Yacht Racing Life Podcast, the show for racing sailors everywhere. Featuring exclusive stories and interviews from across the world of competitive sailing. Hosted by British sailing journalist Justin Chisholm. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm, welcoming you to another episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. Joining me on the show this time is Australian Olympic silver medalist and two-time America's Cup winner with Emirates Team New Zealand, Glenn Ashby. As well as his AC and Olympic achievements, Glenn also holds the wind-powered land speed record with an incredible run of 222.4 kilometers per hour. For the 37th America's Cup in Barcelona last year, Glenn was drafted in to provide some expert punditry as part of the TV commentary team. During our interview, I quiz him about his commentating experience, as well as asking him for his expert breakdown of the teams and the technology behind their respective boats. We round the interview out with some chat about what it's actually like to pilot a craft at 222.4 kilometers per hour, and Glenn also reveals his exciting plans for a new sail-powered record attempt. Glenn, it's been a while since we spoke. We spent a lot of time together in Barcelona during the last America's Cup last summer and autumn. And as is the way with the America's Cup, we never really got a chance to kind of debrief or wrap it up. Everybody just heads for the hills the moment it's over. So it's nice to catch up with you. You're back in Australia, I think, back home with the family. The Cup was pretty intense, wasn't it?
It certainly was, Justin. And yeah, like that, that sort of, I guess that, you know, relentless nature as what you were sort of saying, previously is absolutely the case. I think it's one of those ones that you don't actually realize, you know, how much effort goes into it until it all sort of finishes. And you just realize that, you know, really everybody involved, whether it be sort of, you know, sailing, shore team, the teams, media, you know, commentary, the whole works. Like it is quite rare. You just don't realize how much of a sort of candle burn at both ends it really is. So it's really interesting to see it from a different lens for sure.
Yeah, and you're in a unique position because you've been there as a sailor on several occasions and won it twice, I think. This time around, you stepped away from that and we were lucky enough to have you in the commentary booth, which was great. But it must have been very different for you. Did you step away from it completely, or did you still have a kind of feel for it all, an insider feel for it all?
Yeah, look, I think I'd be lying if I didn't say that I had a bit of an insider feel for it. I was sort of, you know, very aware of, you know, the boat sort of designs and technology and sort of, you know, flowing through from one to the other. You're sort of still very, very connected. Although you weren't sort of there, you know, boots on the ground on a daily operational perspective, you were very, you know, aware of sort of the direction of what all the teams were going, and certainly the design and technology side of things is something that really interests me. So I'm obviously keeping sort of tabs on what was going there. But honestly, you know, the commentary side of things, to see the America's Cup from a completely different perspective, I think for me personally, really rounded out my America's Cup experience over the years, if you like, over the last sort of 10 or 15 years. And I think having that opportunity, which I was very, very thankful to have, and it was a great experience and absolutely learned a lot, and hats off to the professionals that do it all the time. It's bloody hard. Look, it was a great learning opportunity, and I think it was looking at the screen and then actually sort of conveying what you were looking at into words, having been on the boats previously and knowing what they were feeling in certain situations. It almost felt like you're on the boat at times, and some of the, you know, the epic camera work that was taken, you know, in 4K with some of those shots was absolutely incredible. So it was sort of footage that we'd never really seen before. So it really did take you as a viewer, if you like, and I'd sort of classify myself as a viewer sitting in the commentary booth because, you know, you're actually not on the water. You're actually, you know, sitting in the booth in my case. It was super exciting. Like, you could see what the boats were doing. When you're on the boat sailing yourself, you're just in your own little cocoon in your own world. You're sort of looking out of the boat and you're not getting that full perspective of what it is. You only really get to look at another boat when you're looking at your opponent. But when you're looking at it from the helicopter view, if you like, outside looking in, it's incredible to sort of see different things. You can pick up different sail trims, different foil trims, you know, different pitch and trim, different ways the teams were sailing the boat. So, yeah, it was really interesting. I really enjoyed it, and certainly something that you know, I learned a lot about, and felt, you know, feel now that I've sort of seen it from both angles, which is great.
With your expert eye, was there ever a time when you could see something that one of the teams were doing, but you thought, I better not bring that out for the listening audience, the watching audience?
Yeah, look, yeah, honestly, there was times where you're sort of looking at stuff and going, oh, I think I know what's going on here, but I might just keep that to myself. Look, you know, I've tried my best, you know, to keep a very sort of, you know, even, generic, you know, non-biased opinion, you know, right the way through all the series, through the AC40s, you know, women's and youth America's Cup matches as well. You know, it was great to see some fantastic racing. In actual fact, we were really lucky with the weather, you know, as a whole, for the whole event. You know, the schedule was really, you know, kept to pretty keenly, and Ian Murray and his team at race management did a brilliant job sort of getting, you know, the races away when they could, and very, very fair and even competition. I think nobody could complain about that, so hats off to them. And I think, yeah, it was one of those ones, I think, at the end of the day, that could have easily dragged out a lot longer than it did, but Mother Nature played ball, and we sort of got there in the end in a timely manner, which was really good.
You did step away from the sailing. I just wanted to ask you quickly about that. It's a while back now, but why was that? Why didn't you go for another round?
Yeah, look, about 6 months before the 2021 America's Cup in Auckland, in a few years ago now, I sort of got to the point where I was almost feeling like I was sort of running out of gas for, you know, the passion and the fire that I had, you know, of years gone past. So, you know, I was still super, super into what we were doing there and really wanted to defend well. But that was the period I really started to sort of think, you know, what would life be like outside of the cup? You know, what other challenges in life? What other, you know, family activities? What other friends? What other things are there out there that you could, you know, that you could potentially take on? And the dream of, you know, seeing how fast you could go both on land and on water has been something that, you know, wind powered has been something that's been a very, you know, a very big thing for me since I was really young, you know, around sort of 7 or 8 years old. And I started actually thinking that win, lose or draw, you know, was time for me. I had a really good run through my sailing, and with the America's Cup, I was very, very content and happy with, you know, with everything and where I got to. And I was like, wow, I think the next thing for me is really to take on, you know, how fast can you go on any surface, you know, and I sort of took on the land speed project with Team New Zealand, and that was something that was really, really special to take on, you know, with the guys and girls of the team. And you know, it was after the cup. You know, the team did a fantastic job of defending in Auckland, and to be able to go into that land speed project, it almost felt like I was, you know, taking on something that was a lifelong dream. But I also felt that doing that, I'd get a bit of a taste for what else was out there. And once I'd done that, I'm like, wow, I don't think I want to, I think I'm happy, I'm done. And so boots got hung up on the wall, and, you know, I hung onto a steering wheel in a land yacht and did that. And we got to 225.58 kilometers an hour and broke the record. And I thought, wow, I'd like to do some more of this. I'd like to break a few more records. So that's where my focus has sort of shifted. And I still love the America's Cup, still, you know, very involved in, you know, sort of thinking about it. I think about it every day. And I don't think I'm ever going to really depart from, you know, the America's Cup in my mind, but from a sailing perspective and just a, you know, a want and a need and a fire in the belly side of things, I was just super content. So I thought, if you're 95%, you're not 100%, like you're 5% short, and you need to be 100%, you need to be 110% to be successful in the America's Cup as a sailor. And I thought, well, I've had a good run. I've definitely put in 100 or 110% for a long time. Might be time to recharge the gas tank.
I want to get into that whole land speed record a little later in the podcast.
Yeah, no worries.
Let's just close off on the commentary side of things. You were working with a couple of pros, Shirley Robertson, very experienced, and Stephen McIver, another very experienced presenter, although he's done one cup, but you know, still not perhaps known for as a sailing commentator. And you had Peter Lester on the water. It was a pretty good team, I thought, and I liked the product. I enjoyed the experience of it all. I think people immediately forget just where you are, and they imagine you're kind of floating above the racecourse in some disembodied form that you can see all of this stuff going on. But just, it's a bit less glamorous than that, isn't it? Just describe your working environment.
It certainly is less glamorous. If the people watching are feeling like you are having that helicopter view, then you're probably telling a good story. So I guess that's probably a good thing as a group. But no, look, we're basically doing the commentary. Peter Lester was on the water in a chase boat, but he was the only one out there on the water and very difficult to sort of follow the boats at high speed. So he'd often see the start and the first part of it and then work his way up the boundary, so he wouldn't see everything. But Shirley, Stephen and myself were basically in a 20-foot Portacom container, basically, with about five screens we were looking at, sort of very, very much in a row, all sort of looking at sort of separate screens. You have to learn to look at each other sideways, back and forwards, because it's really easy to get in the moment and sort of talk over each other, or you know, you're coming into a mark rounding where, you know, we would have to lay out to let Stephen sort of do his part of the program. You know, Stephen did a really, really good job of sort of the opening and closing and really sort of tying it all together. I mean, to have lots of voices going through your ears and getting all the timing right, and Shirley, an absolute expert as well. You know, I felt like I was just sort of, you know, sitting back and just watching. And then once it got rolling, you could sort of chip in because the sailing side you understood well. But from a product perspective, it was a really new experience for me. And I learned a lot. And I think, for those, you know, hats off to those seasoned professional commentators in all sports that actually do it, because it is way, way, way harder and way more to it than sort of what hits the eye. You think you just sort of sit down and have the chat, but there is so much going on, and live TV is its own beast. There's always, as you know, hiccups. There'll be a delay or there'll be a change or something. So the whole schedule has to continuously roll. So the producers and the production managers, you know, and everybody involved is just sort of constantly on their toes for a changing environment and then rolling that through and meeting the timing schedules. And yeah, absolutely unbelievable experience. So you go into the production gallery, which for me, I'd never really been into before as a sailor or as a team member. And, you know, there's sort of, you know, 100-odd people working behind the scenes, you know, sound engineers, picture control, you know, camera controllers, picture editors, you know, replays. There's just so much going on. It's actually quite mind-blowing. And to be able to be involved with that and try and, I guess, paint a little bit of a picture for the audience of what it was like to be actually sailing on the boats or what was going on. For me, looking at it, it was super easy to understand what was sort of going on. But you know, for some of the other people that had never been, you know, some of the sound engineers, for example, had never been on an AC-75, you know, to try and, you know, work with them to place microphones and pick up the sounds of the boats and how the hydraulics were working and that sort of thing was a fantastic opportunity to sort of really work together as a team and actually try and, you know, create the best possible product we could for our sport to actually bring it up to an international level. So it was a great experience, and I've met some really, really fantastic, you know, highly skilled people in a totally different field that I'd never, ever thought, you know, 6 or 8, 12 months ago that I ever would. So I feel very, very lucky.
I remember you said to me one day in the media center, and I think I'd said to you, oh, great job yesterday or whatever. And you said, oh, you know, this is not my comfort zone. This is not my second career after sailing. So you always sounded so assured while you were presenting. But was it nerve-wracking?
Oh, look, it was. I mean, for me, to listen to your own voice, you know, or replay, even when things get replayed, you're like, oh, is that how I sound? It's like, well, that's brutal. I don't think I'm listening to myself ever again. But look, it's one of those ones you just, you know, you were there, I guess, to sort of try and do a job and do that job to the best of your ability. And, you know, I've grown up loving sailing, and to be able to have the opportunity to, you know, talk about the racing and I guess being involved with, you know, the America's Cup, but particularly, you know, I guess being involved with sort of the design phase of the AC75s and then, you know, sailing those and then actually, you know, being able to sort of talk about them in a commentary sense at the actual America's Cup. It was great. You know, it actually, once you got into it, it was, you sort of, you got quite comfortable, but you just, the concentration, you know, and watching from the cameras is, you know, really takes out quite a lot of energy because there's so much going on and so many different camera angles and so many different feeds coming in as well as audio you can pick up as well. It's there's a lot of information going on. I can only do one or two things at once, so I can't do three or four or more, so like a lot of other people can, so I've got to keep it simple for sure.
I always feel sorry for a commentary team on a day when the wind isn't cooperating and there's delays and you guys have to backfill, and I know we showed a lot of previous racing and that sort of stuff, but there were times when you basically had to fill 20 minutes with chat.
Oh, yeah, look, cousin Phil definitely played a big part in that commentary team. It was brutal. That was probably, to be honest, the hardest part of the whole thing, was just, you know, delay, and then it'd be like you'd have, you know, 30 seconds to do a fill, and then they'd be onto a VT, you know, videotape sort of thing, and then they'd be back and you'd talk for a minute, and then that was, you know, pretty hard and pretty relentless. But at the same time, there's so many different things to talk about, I guess, with the Cup, and probably harder for Stephen in some ways, not being his, you know, he's a motorsport commentator, not a sailing, you know, necessarily a sailing commentator, although he did a really good job and picking up a lot of stuff. For Shirley and myself, for example, and for Pete, it's been our whole lives, so we could sort of talk about a whole lot of different range of things. And, you know, when you've only got a minute to try and discuss a particular topic, which you could take probably an hour on, it's pretty hard to condense it all. So it was really interesting, and I think, well, hopefully we got through, you know, a few topics. But, yeah, certainly those days when there wasn't much wind, you definitely felt like you were earning your money, that's for sure.
Hi, everybody. Justin Chisholm here with a quick message. We do hope you're enjoying this episode of the Yacht Racing Live podcast, and we wanted you to know that you can get more great content from around the world of sailboat racing on the Yacht Racing Live website. There's plenty of free content to check out, and premium subscribers get all areas access to the site. Head over to yachtracinglife.com/YRL pod for a lifetime 50% off the regular monthly premium subscription price. You managed to stamp your own authority on it in a very cool way. I thought that the little one-liners, the little throw-ins, like, it, you know, that must be like riding a teapot through a set of moguls. The little Ashby-isms that I started writing them down. I thought it was great. Was that a deliberate ploy? I remember you talked about Gridoni in Saudi, and I think Stephen had said, he's full of confidence. And you said, yeah, well, when you're that age, you think you're made of rubber and springs. I just thought that was brilliant.
Oh, look, it's just, I mean, what comes, you know, I've grown up, I guess, you know, in central Victoria in the bush, and, you know, sometimes what comes out of a mouth is probably not the most PC things. And sometimes I go, oh, crikey, probably shouldn't have said that. But I was like, I just have to be myself. If I ever try and be somebody that I'm not, then it's never going to work. So I thought, if I, you know, just be myself from the start, and speaking to Leon Sefton, who's sort of the, you know, the producer, production manager, he said, just talk to the pitchers, Glenn, just be yourself. You know, you'll get told if you say something wrong. So I literally just thought, oh, look, I'll just be myself. And sometimes things are just rolled off your tongue because you were just watching the screens. It just came out. I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have said that. But in the end, I'm like, well, you know, it's live TV, it's live sport. Play on. So it's the other way.
You mentioned Leon Sefton there, and Leon ran that whole TV empire. And he's a wonderful voice in your ear, isn't he? I did a little bit of commentary from a helicopter at a Volvo Ocean Race stopover import race, and I was terrified. But Leon in your ear just, you know, just gave you this like calming, everything's fine, even though where he was sitting, everything was happening at the same time.
Yeah, the production gallery could be on fire and, you know, be full of smoke and everything blowing up in there. And I think Leon would just be the same cool, calm, collected voice, like nothing was going on. And that is an absolute skill. And seeing Leon, you know, in his trenches doing what he does best was amazing. And to all the people that take that on, that is one high-pressure job. I'd sort of liken that to, you know, being a flight controller in a busy airport, but, you know, doing it for a sort of, you know, 2 or 3 hours and not making a mistake and super, super, you know, intense concentration, but day after day after day, race after race. And, you know, Leon, you know, I'd spent a little bit of time with Leon over the years, and fortunately Leon actually took on the documentary for the Land Speed project, which I talked about earlier, the Land of Speed. And so Leon and I spent a fair bit of time in the desert together, you know, in some pretty isolated places. And, you know, that was probably out of Leon's comfort zone, going out to those sort of locations. And then to go through that with him and the team, and then actually sort of produce that documentary, and then actually go into Leon's environment, I was totally out of my comfort zone and he was in his comfort zone. So we were, you know, it was great to sort of have that bond, if you like, through that experience over that last sort of year and a half, 2 years. And, you know, Leon, really, really great mate and a very, very special guy, and did an amazing job. So, yeah, I'm sure he'll be in the game for a long time.
I'm sure. All right, let's take you out of the commentary booth and just talk about the Cup itself. And first of all, I wanted to ask about the boats this time around. To the untrained eye, you'd say they look kind of similar to the boats at the last Cup, but very, very different, aren't they? Can you talk about that for us for a sec?
Sure. Yeah, I guess the main difference probably, well, probably two or three main differences from the last Cup, but really the big ones were probably the weight of the boats, which sort of did, we talked a little bit about, but probably didn't talk a huge amount about. So the boats are about 1,000 kilograms all up lighter with, you know, two less crew. The 2021 sort of no bow sprit, a lot less structure in the boats for not having to sort of carry, you know, big front sails. So the fact that the boats were so much lighter and also had much higher aspect ratio foils, so a lot longer sort of main foils, if you like, or the lifting surface part of the foils, that lighter weight, higher aspect ratio foils really lowered the takeoff speed of the boats for sort of taking off out of the water. So whereas in Auckland, we were sort of 7.5-8 knots of true wind speed to try and sort of get up out of the water and get going, you know, in 6.5 knots of wind speed, which is not a lot of wind on the water, that, you know, that's at sort of 10 meters. So on the water, you'd be sort of looking at like sometimes, you know, 3.5, 4, 5 knots of wind on the actual water surface, like we normally look at, really, really light air. But the boats were such high performance and so light that they could actually take off. And we were seeing fantastic racing in, you know, 6 to sort of 8 knots of breeze. And the boats were doing, you know, 25 to sort of 40 knots of boat speed in barely any wind. So that was probably the biggest difference, I think, between the boats, really, between, you know, from a physical perspective in, you know, from 2021 through to last year in 24. And the other thing that was probably quite a bit different was the ability to regenerate the oil power. So from one function, you could send the oil to another function. So for example, you could, with one button press, you could ease the main sheet and that oil would go into the Cunningham or the Clue or the Mast rotation or vice versa. So in different maneuvers, you could basically adjust, you know, multiple functions at once and sort of recycle the oil, if you like. So the cyclores that were actually powering the boats, you know, they're obviously putting in a huge effort, but you think how many functions they could power by sort of electricity, if you like, and that PLC controller, programmable logic controller, that the mechatronics teams would sort of work on to adjust the valves and oil flow for all the functions. So absolutely incredible amount of sort of tuning and at the electronics and hydraulic controllability, if you like, of the sail surfaces. So remembering that everything from the sort of the deck up was controlled by a human, and everything from the deck down, all the foils, was controlled by batteries. So they were probably the biggest differences, I'd say, from 2021 to 2024. You know, and some of the VMG numbers or velocity made good, boat speeds, particularly in the lighter air, in the windier conditions, not a huge amount of difference between the boats, but in that sort of 6 to probably 12 knot range, particularly upwind, the boat's performance was a lot better than it was in Auckland. But the physical size of the boats, the rig height, the sail plans, the twin skin mainsails, for example, very, very similar to last time. But yeah, as I said, the weight and the foils were probably the main differences.
That linking of functions together is quite hard to get your head around, because they're not allowed to automate anything, right? That's kind of a no-no. And yet it sounds a bit like automation, doesn't it? Because I'm going to ease the main so the Cunningham and the outhaul get adjusted in the same button press.
Yeah, you'd sort of call it like almost like a semi-automatic setting where, for example, you could turn with, and this was all within the rules, you could turn a dial, for example, to say you were sailing from 10 knots and you went to 12 knots, you could, or somebody on board could turn that knob to 12, for example, if you went from 10 to 12, and then all the functions on the boat would adjust to that 12 knot setting, for example, and you'd also have a boat speed setting and an angle setting. So with three or four sort of tunable items that could be done either by the cyclaws or by the trimmers or the helmsman, you could effectively adjust the boat semi-automatically. You're still having to manually adjust all the, you know, like adjusting your radio with old knobs, but you could tune into whatever radio station you like, for example. So it would basically then adjust the Cunningham. It's like a powering up and a powering down button, whereas normally you'd have to go, I want to pull the Cunningham or I want to pull the main sheet on, and you have to sort of use 10 buttons to do that. Now you could sort of do it with one button or one dial, which could then, providing you'd pre-tuned everything and you had all the right settings and done a lot of testing, you could more simply power up and depower the boats through manoeuvres and also through puffs and lulls and different tactical situations. So you also had the ability to override that and go fully manual as well. So you also had, you know, if you looked inside the cockpit, there is just hundreds of buttons, literally, in each side of the cockpits that you can use for different situations. And you look in as a non-AC-75 sailor, as a normal yachtie, for example, off a keelboat, and you look down and you go, holy, it's like looking into a spaceship. But, you know, if you'd never been into a modern car before, if you just sort of leapfrogged into, you know, driving a modern car now, the amount of buttons and functionality on that is unbelievable. And it takes you, you know, you jump in a new car, it takes you days to work out, you know, where everything is. And if you can imagine having gone from a 1980s model car to a, you know, a 2025 model car, it's really different and it takes a bit of time. But once you've spent weeks or months driving the car, you don't have to look where the buttons are. You just know exactly where everything is. And just that practice and a lot of time in the simulator, those buttons are all exactly in the same place. So you spend some time on the sim, you can fast forward months or even years of normal sailing to get your muscle memory working exactly as it needs to do when you jump on the boat. So you can sort of fast forward time and it just becomes super easy and you don't even have to think about it. It just happens by thinking about it.
You made a good point there about you press a button and it goes to a particular configuration of the sails or the boat, but you have to get that configuration right in the first place. So and when you talk about testing to get that right, a lot of that, I think, was done on the computer. There was a lot of, I'm guessing, AI involved in that said the computer thinks this is the perfect setup for the boat in these wind conditions and these waves, but then you have to go and validate it.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, use of, you know, computing power, you know, through all, you know, all sports, all technology is definitely almost vertical. And the VPP, which sort of a lot of people talk about, you know, the variable prediction program that basically all the teams have to try and optimize, you know, for a given wind speed, sea state, boat configuration, that VPP basically sort of spits out, if you like, a set of parameters or settings that as a sailor, if you can set the boat up to those parameters, in theory, you should be able to sail the boat to the best of its performance. So at 100% of what it's capable of doing. Obviously there's, you know, there's wind shifts, there's, you know, waves, there's different things that come into effect. So as a yachtsman or woman, you are trying to sail the boat to 100% VMG as much as you possibly can. It's really difficult to do. You can sort of fudge the numbers to make you, you know, or the design team can fudge the numbers to make you look really good as a sailor or really bad if you're not getting to numbers. But at the end of the day, as a team, you're wanting to keep, you know, upping the bar, if you like, for the VPP setting. So, you know, you're getting faster and faster all the time. So those settings, if you don't go and test those settings accurately, you don't ever, and that's a lot of hours on the water, a lot of validation, but also a lot of simulator. If you don't get to validate the simulator versus reality accurately, you don't get to sail the boat accurately. And there'll be times where you'll go to adjust a global setting, but the main sheet might not come on enough, and you'll be too twisted versus too flat, or you'll be too stored versus too deep, and so the boat will be out of balance. So that tuning process through the build-up to the last America's Cup was really where a lot of the teams spent a lot of time developing, because if they did that well and they directed the oil to the right places, it made the cyclores much more efficient. It meant you could change gears more quickly and do greater gear changes in a changing environment, particularly in a match race, which is very, very, you know, difficult, and you're often sailing the boat out of VMG target against your opponent. So if you could change gears well, be efficient, in the end, in theory, you'd then have an advantage over your opponent if you did that well.
Who do you think did that the best?
Look, I think, without a doubt, I think Team New Zealand really, I think, in really, I almost, and look, I this might sound a bit biased, but I don't think I'm alone in saying this, but I think they were probably better and actually probably set the bar pretty much in most departments, I think, whether it be mechatronics, hydraulics, sails, foothills, hull. You know, in the end, they just did a little bit better job than all the other teams. And you know, Ineos did a really, really, really great job. I really love their design philosophy and what they were doing with all the aerodynamic side of things. And I loved all that. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. But I think, you know, Team New Zealand in the end were just a little more polished in more areas, you know, globally. And I think in the end that really made the difference between winning and losing. And I think certainly from a foil perspective and a mechatronics perspective, I think they were probably the two areas that, to me personally, were possibly a little standout compared to most of the teams. You know, obviously Ineos made it through to the final and did a brilliant job, you know, against Luna Rossa and all the other teams, in actual fact. And I think in the end, you know, I think the cream just simply rose to the top, and you know, the best sort of team, if you like. You know, you never win it as a sailing team, just a sailing team. It's the global team that actually wins the America's Cup. And I think in the end, Team New Zealand, you know, just proved again to be, you know, that strong team.
British boat arguably was the most radical looking, again, to the untrained eye. It had bumps and curves and dimples and you know, it was a strange looking boat. There's no other way of putting it. And yet it got to the final, and it took two races off the Kiwis. And I felt that if we'd had another day of bumpy, windy conditions, they may have taken some more races off. I mean, it could have been quite a different cut. Well, when you look at that boat, you say you know you like the design philosophy. How did it differ from what the Kiwis were doing?
It's a great question. I think there was, my view on this personally, I think there was clearly a big influence from Mercedes and their aerodynamic department in their boat. I think their ability and their modelling and their tool development to model, you know, aerodynamically the hull, and it's not, you know, you can't just model the hull. You've got to have the rig and the foils, and you have to actually model the whole package through a whole lot of different trim ranges to actually globally, you know, work out what to do with the hull and how to make things better, exactly the same as a car. And obviously Mercedes have been absolute, you know, at the top of their game for a long time, you know, in the past with Formula One, and their aerodynamic department you know, their knowledge of developing tools to analyze what makes things fast, I think was clearly evident. And that's where I really was quite excited when I first saw their boat. I was like, oh, this is the future. Like, this is actually, you know, there's bumps, as you said, bumps and dimples and, you know, fairings and wings and all sorts of things going on. And I, within the rules, I'm like, this is cutting edge America's Cup technology. This is the absolute state of the art, you know, yacht racing in the world. There's nothing at a greater level than this. And, you know, I think they did a great job with their rigs and sails. And I also think their positioning of their flight controllers, I think, you know, Lee McMillan and Bled and Mon, I think where they were positioned further aft, so they actually had a different view, and the way they actually trimmed the foils was very visual compared to what Team New Zealand and Luda Rossa did, which was very much more off screens and cameras. I think that ability to visually gauge your horizon and what the boat's pitch was doing and roll and the foil reminded me very much more of what it would be like flying an aircraft, you know, visual versus, you know, IFR on your instruments. And, you know, I think with the type of sailing that we're doing, you're effectively flying the boat, which is effectively an aircraft, but you're flying it just off the water surface. So you can't make many mistakes. Like, you're literally going through the water. So I think what Lee and Bledden could predict, especially on those bumpy days, on the flatter days, not so much of a difference, but you could argue even off the instruments, maybe you're better doing a better job off the instruments when it's flatter. But as soon as it was bumpy and there was a bit of randomness and, you know, remembering that the cameras and when you're sitting down in the cockpit, you can only really see what's happening at the foil. You can't really see super far in front of the boat. Whereas I think Lee and Bledden's position allowed them to basically almost have a predictive sense of what was coming, and they could preempt, you know, what was happening further down the track. And I think what we saw, their controllability when it got really lumpy and wavy, yes, they were still moving around a lot and they had a few little wobbles here and there, but I think globally they could fly their boat very, very accurately and push the boat extremely hard, particularly downwind, which I thought, you know, as we saw through the round robins and the finals, you know, they were taking some huge chunks out of the other teams, you know, at times when they got locked in big waves. And that was impressive to me. So I think they were probably the two biggest differences, you know, between Team New Zealand and Ineos, was the way they flew the boat. In the end, though, when you actually broke down the numbers of the performance, there was very, very little in it. So we just, you know, it was very much a refinement process. Although both hulls, if you like, were extremely different and the foils were you know, quite different from both boats, in the end, the performance was really, really similar. So it was interesting to see two totally different aerodynamic conditions performing so similarly. And I think that's exciting for the future, because it means that, you know, there is going to be, you know, gains going forward for the subsequent Cup. So the teams that I think that will do well in the future will be the ones that actually develop their tools and their analysis structure really, really accurately. That will feed into a fast design in the future. And as we know, the fastest boat, you know, always wins the America's Cup.
Just, you mentioned the foils there. Just, I've heard people say at the end of the day, it's great, the hulls are fantastic, that they're more aerodynamic or whatever. But it comes down to the foils. X percent of the drag is in the foils, you know? Were they very different, the foils, on those two boats? Because I honestly can't remember now.
Yeah, look, it's a bit of a while ago. I have to think back myself. But yeah, look, they were quite different. You know, Team New Zealand sort of opted for a continuous sort of surface top foil. Ineos, you know, sort of a more of a sliding sort of a structure, still with flaps, both foils needing to be sort of flat, if you like, to actually change the lift characteristics. Hydrodynamically, you know, is, you know, compared to aerodynamically, you know, your water's sort of, you know, a thousand times denser than air. So although the foils are really, really small, you know, the drag of the foils, because that's really the only part in the water once you're up and going, you know, that really does, you know, make a big difference. It's the sum of the parts for sure. Like if you've got a really good foil, a really good hull, but not very good sails, like you'll still be slow. So you've got to have that package really working for you. And that's where really the America's Cup is all about, developing the global package through a big range of conditions. And really, I think in the end, I think the ability of Team New Zealand to gain in the tacks particularly, that was probably one of the biggest differences. I think once the both boats sort of got accelerated and they're up to speed, nothing, you can throw a blanket over both boats, but in the tacks we saw time and time again, Team New Zealand would just take a little chunk. They'd take half a boat length here and there, and that really at the end of the day, if you're sort of doing, you know, 4, 5, 6 tacks or more per beat, you take a half a boat length gain each time, there's 3 boat lengths. And you don't need, like, 3 boat lengths is a lot on a 75-footer. So that really at the end, I think, was that ability to sort of adjust the foil setup and the boat setup, I think gave Team New Zealand a little click every time they sort of did those manoeuvres. And it wasn't every time they made a gain, but when they did a good one, and Ineos might have had a slightly little wobble, it was very, very evident. So, but, you know, obviously everybody that was there and all the recon and all the people there, the engineers and the designers, they would have pored over the photos with a fine-tooth comb. So what we'll see as we move forward with the America's Cup is, again, as the AC75 class will go forward in another iteration, there'll be some adjustments and there'll be some tweaks. But the class itself will move forward and there'll be a new set of sort of refined, updated rules, if you like there is for a lot of other classes every year or two. We'll see another further convergence of design and possibly even some more one design components. Who knows? That's up to Team New Zealand to make things that, you know, are costly items that don't make a huge difference. Maybe everyone will agree that, look, you know, let's just all have the same fees, but let's open up some other areas a little bit more that will actually make a bit more of a difference, or will push, you know, the boundaries of technology forward. So that's exciting. So those sort of things that really excite me going forwards.
Are you interested in advertising your product or service on the Yacht Racing Life podcast? It's really simple. Go to yachtracinglife.com/advertising to find out how. What's an example of something that could be made one design, in your opinion?
Good question. Look, I think maybe even some of the programmable logic, the PLC control, you know, foil control, or you know, some of the systems, for example, hydraulic systems could be made one design. You know, the main sheet system, for example, or Cunningham systems, or parts like that. Potentially, you know, take a huge amount of engineering resource and time to develop. But, you know, whether you've got one main sheet ram or another, is that really going to win or lose you the cup? Probably not. But, you know, is having a rudder foil or a foil actuation that's slightly different, that's big ticket item stuff. So if you could sort of, you know, a little bit like Formula One, sort of focus on the parts that, you know, obviously keep the rules tight enough, but if you still allow enough freedom, then you can, as a design group and a team, you can explore those edges of the box, if you like, for the games. And I think that's the America's Cup. I mean, it's a design race. It's so I think having the right amount open, you know, is really important. And I think, you know, Team New Zealand are very aware that, you know, they want to have it as exciting and as good as it possibly can be. Yes, they want to win, of course, like all the teams do over the years. But I think, you know, the rules are such that, you know, really any of the teams, if they do a good job, they will knock Team New Zealand off their perch.
Do you think the gap has narrowed now to Team New Zealand? I've heard differing things that, you know, Grant Dalton has said we need to 8 times our computing power if we're gonna fend off a challenge, you know, such as that's backed by a Mercedes, say, or another Formula One team.
I think there's a tidal wave of, you know, of energy coming in behind all the other teams. And I think Team New Zealand very much know that they are the target and they are at risk of getting mown down. Like, there's absolutely no question that you know, they'll be working extremely hard on, you know, where to look to for the future games, as will all the teams. So I think they very much are in a super strong position and did a brilliant job. But at the same time, you know, they're always looking for what's happening in the future. And, you know, in the America's Cup, you know, weeks feel like years, you know. So the teams, you know, we saw Ineos, just the rate of improvement, you know, coming into that final sort of series, like they were leaps and bounds in their gain rate going forward. So, you know, if they had have started that 2 weeks earlier, like, would we have still had the same result? Would they have overtaken Emirates Stadium New Zealand? We'll never know. But they gained very, very quickly. And I think the ability for teams to, you know, find not the silver bullet, but find a grouping of silver bullets that they can put together and mould as one that can give them an edge, that's what they'll be looking to do. And I think the computing power is going to be one of the biggest things going forward. I think with probably all sports, even swimming and sports that, you know, are largely just body-based, the modelling now of how you run, how you swim, how you jump is unbelievable compared to what it was, you know, even 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And you look back even 5 years ago at the America's Cup boats, and they, in you know, they sort of look like dinosaurs compared to what we saw, you know, just a few months ago. So it's going to be incredible what we see over the next sort of, you know, 1, 2, 3, 5, 10 years. And you think, wow, what's everything going to look like in 10 years' time? It's going to be interesting.
It is going to be interesting. Let's just take a really quick run through the other teams, because we focused on the Kiwis and the Brits, and you know, they got to the final. But some interesting challenges. The French, and I know you did a little bit of work with them early on. What was your view of them? My view is if they'd had the funding earlier, they would have been a pretty potent force.
Yeah, look, I think the French certainly, you know, look, no question, you in a straight line, you know, their boat speed was just fine, you know, and they had obviously the same design package as Emirates Team New Zealand. I think, yeah, they were just sort of a little bit late to the table, which I think was probably the biggest thing, and just lacking possibly the ability to develop the mechatronics and hydraulic side quickly when they got the boat. That was probably something that I think if the whole team could sort of look back and say where we have put more resource possibly earlier on when the boat went on the water, that may have actually got the you know, Orient Express up to, you know, racing around the track a bit more quickly, because they were still sort of, you know, getting the boat sort of dialed in almost at race time. So that they sort of the runway sort of ended before they really got to actually take off properly. And you know, I think another week or two of sort of debugging and actually tuning the boat itself, and I think we, you know, they could have easily taken some big scalps. You know, they weren't far off it, and they were still, you know, very much on a vertical part of their learning curve. So unfortunate for the French. I mean, they did a really, really great job, but yeah, I just think just a little bit late to the table, really that sort of was costly in the end, and they were the first one to exit the competition.
And then the Swiss, fully funded early, produced a boat which was, when it arrived, it kind of looked radical. I wasn't sure whether it was, it didn't look immediately to me like it was going to be a fast boat, but I don't think it was a slow boat either. Were they just a bit lacking in experience because they went down this all Swiss bunch of youngsters kind of nationalistic team?
Look, I think certainly, you know, it was the first America's Cup for a lot of the sailors on board. You know, new team, very much, you know, hadn't been in the scene for quite a few years. It was sort of, you know, 2010, I think, from memory, on the Big Cat. And look, I think the Swiss, they would have been pleased in some regards, I think, with some of their performances, but also disappointed in some regards with some of their performances as well. And I think in a straight line, at times their boat was a little, just a click off the pace compared to some of the other teams. So I think potentially their hull itself, I think was, you know, this is my personal opinion, I think the hull itself was was potentially quite okay. Their foils, to me, were probably the Achilles heel for Alinghi in their pace relative to a couple of other teams. At times, they were just okay, but there were some conditions, I think, where, you know, their ride height and their foil design was possibly just holding them back a click, and you only need to get a little bit low, pick up a little bit of extra wetted surface area, and you take a little step back. So, look, I think experience was probably a little bit of a one, but also a little bit of design as well. So, and look, they will be a force to be reckoned with as we go forwards in the future. There's absolutely no question. You know, fantastic pathway. They were on the table and they were mixing it up. So absolutely in the future, they'll be one of the top teams, no doubt.
The Americans, they were, I think, went out a little earlier than some people might have expected them to do.
Look, obviously a huge tragedy, you know, with Paul Goodison, you know, injuring his ribs, right before the main part of the regatta, and we all just felt so bad, you know, for Paul and the team, that all that effort and all that work, and then you're sort of having to make a change late. Lucas Calabresi stepping up to the plate, what a brilliant job he did. That is properly sitting in the hot seat and a big set of boots to fill. And he did a really, really good job, and hats off to Lucas. And I felt, you know, really, really, you know, bad for poor old Paul to miss out on, you know, that opportunity. But again, you know, pairing up with, you know, someone like Tom Slingsby, who's, you know, absolutely one of the best in the business, you know, I think Tom did a really solid job in the racecraft of how they sailed their boat, and some of the positions they put themselves in and some of the pre-starts was spectacular. And, you know, Tommy did a really good job there with the team to, you know, push that boat as fast as they possibly could. And, you know, they were just so close so many times to winning races where they were just a boat length or two off it. And, you know, I think in the end, just probably that sort of disruption, if you like, of, you know, a bit of a change of guard. I think performance-wise, I think American Magic was, you know, in a straight line, you know, they were quick. They were a quick boat, and very, very different design philosophy with the recumbent cyclores. You know, very, very low projected frontal area on their platform. So really, really different aerodynamic package to Ineos, for example. Like, you put those two boats side by side or look at them front on and you're like, wow, do the rules allow them? But, you know, they're open enough that they did, and super, super different looking boats. But yet again, you know, different aerodynamic packages achieving very, very similar outcomes in the way they sailed their boat. You'd often see different cant angles, both boats sailing at different heel angles in different conditions, getting the absolute best out of their own individual packages. So I think American Magic, you know, can be very, very proud of their achievement. And I know for a fact that, you know, if they will continue on, which, you know, I'm sure they will, they will be, I think, one of the strongest teams that will come up against the other challengers in the future, for sure.
And then the Italians, who I think a lot of people had them down as favourites to go up against the Kiwis in the final, but they got outfoxed by the British. As a Brit, I was happy about that, but there was a lot of passion behind that team and a lot of expertise and excellent sailing.
Look, I think, honestly, I think, you know, most of the people in Barcelona were sort of expecting, if you like, Luna Rossa to come through and be in the final with Emirates Team New Zealand. I, you know, when people ask me who's the strongest team, you know, sort of 2, 3, 4 months out from the cup, I was like, wow, Luna Rossa are looking pretty polished, you know, looking pretty slick and sailing the boat well and, you know, relative to the other teams. But look, in the end, I think, you know, for sure they'd be disappointed and still be disappointed. You know, they had a beautiful boat, a beautiful package. You know, they had a couple of breakages, which were super unfortunate, you know, during the regatta. And we know how on edge, you know, the boats are in so many different areas. But just a little bit of bad luck, which happens, you know, at events sometimes. We've all been at those events where you know, you have breakages and bad luck. That happens in all different sports. But I think, really for Luna Rossa, you know, the conditions that they faced against British were quite windy, bumpy conditions. And I think Luna Rossa's package, I think, was very much more set up from a design philosophy which suited the lighter to medium conditions, probably a little bit more like what Emirates Team New Zealand were targeting. And I think, honestly, Ineos were probably, they all had the same weather data and they're all probably targeting a similar thing. But the way it panned out in the end was that, you know, Ineos's uprange performance got better and better and better very, very quickly. And they were just literally sailing the boat better and better each day, obviously making adjustments and tuning. And, you know, there's a whole lot of people behind the scenes. But I think the sailing team, you know, did a nice job with the design team of identifying on board Ineos where the gains were. I know Rob Wilson and the guys worked really hard on, you know, putting the pieces of the puzzle together to make gains. I felt that Luna Rossa sort of almost got a little bit caught out possibly with their setup in those conditions. They had very, very fine leading edges on their vertical part of their foils, which are very, very, you know, good for low drag in flatter water, but not very tolerant to angle of attack change. And they were actually ventilating their foils quite a lot, which meant that the helmsman, Jimmy and Keiko, couldn't really drive the boat as aggressively, particularly in the pre-starts, as what Ineos could do. And they were really on edge of actually sort of losing grip, if you like, so sort of spinning out. And I think those conditions, what we saw was that they were having to sort of back off, you know, in how aggressively they actually pushed that boat to not spin out and lose the rudder or actually ventilate the foil. And we did see some big foil ventilations and some loss of the rudders on board Luna Rossa. And, you know, possibly just the way Mother Nature played out, it just, in the end, it just suited Ineos a bit better than Luna Rossa. And, you know, they, again, you know, with those couple of breakages, just, yeah, very, very disappointing for them. So they were probably themselves probably the most disappointed of everybody. And I think for probably everyone watching and certainly the Italian fans, it was probably the most disappointing for them as well, because they really were a polished, you know, package. And Luna Rossa as a team, very, very polished team with a lot of fantastic people behind the scenes. So just a little bit of bad luck. And unfortunately, they didn't make it through to have a go at Team New Zealand in the final.
I think an exciting future, though, for the Italians in the Cup, that, you know, these new sailors that are coming through, Ruggero Tito and Marco Gradoni, who won the youth America's Cup, like super talents that they can build a team around, I think, going forward, because they've got the technical ability, they've got the funding. I think the future's pretty bright for them.
It certainly is. Look, without a doubt, you know, the Luna Rossa, and I think, you know, Italian sailing is at such a high level at the moment. You know, they're spoiled for choice, you know, with who they've got coming through, and both in the women's and the youth, you know, AC 40s, they just set the bar. And it was incredible to see, you know, both those AC 40 performances. And we know that those young girls and guys coming through, you know, they are going to be an absolute force to be reckoned with in the future. They've got all the makings of greatness, you know, in the sport going forwards. And if they can connect well with the designers and the engineers, give accurate feedback, work hard, you know, keep your head down and actually just do the necessary things that they need to do and be team players, they will have an opportunity to win the America's Cup for sure.
For sure. Just a couple of questions left on the Cup, and then I want to get on to the land speed record and just cover that off. Who do you think will be back from these teams that competed last time? Who's coming back? And where are the new teams going to come from, if at all?
That's a great question. I was actually going to ask you, Justin, what's happening over there. And at the moment, there's a bit going on.
Yeah, the British situation is as we're recording this, is a little bit concerning, because obviously we've got the split between Jim Ratcliffe and Ben Ainslie, which isn't helping. Maybe we'll end up with two teams, you know?
Well, but, I was actually going to say that is potentially, you know, an outcome that would be super interesting moving forward. I mean, it's obviously, you know, we all don't know what's going on behind the scenes there, but if you know, there was, you know, and a lot can happen in a day, a lot can happen in a week, and certainly months. But if there was, you know, two British challengers, wow, that would be unreal for the going forwards. I mean, what a battle that would be, you know, moving forwards. Maybe I'll let him come back in the commentary booth to commentate a couple of those races. Yeah. That might be good. But if I get invited back. But look, I think existing teams, I think, you know, we'll see Alinghi back on the table. I think we'll see American Magic most likely back on the table. I think, look, there could be other countries that are sort of waiting in the wings. I don't really know. You know, in my lifetime, I would love to, you know, as a green and gold Speedo wearer on the beach at times. No, not really, but, you know, as someone who is from Australia, it'd be great at some point to see an Australian challenge, you know, get up. Whether that ever happens, I don't know, but that'd be amazing. But I think, yeah, look, I think we will see more teams in the next America's Cup than what we've seen in the previous. And I would say as a guess, I think we'd see potentially two, or maybe even three more teams. But we'd have to see. And again, that comes down to, you know, the protocol. It comes down to the timing, and it comes down to the class rule. And if there's teams that have the ability to, you know, come to the table and mix it up, then. And they can do that, you know, in a realistic time frame and sort of budget, I guess, if you like, then I can't see any reason why we won't see more teams coming forward. Maybe from Spain, who knows?
Maybe from Sweden. Maybe Artemis make a return.
Maybe that would be fantastic to see Artemis back again. And, you know, I think for the whole sailing world and for world sport, if we can see some of these teams, you know, new and old, you know, come back to the table and actually go forwards. I think, I mean, if you could have, you know, 8 or 10 teams again in an A75 environment, fantastic. I mean, what an unbelievable sight that would be to have that many teams fighting it out, like we've seen in previous editions. And the fact that the class, the AC75 class, has remained and it's moving forward definitely is an enticement for new teams to come in, because you can get up to speed so much more quickly. There's so much more knowledge available, and you know, and personnel available that understand that get the game. So, you know, I think it's I think the America's Cup's in a great space, and let's hope it continues that way for a long time.
Do you think the way in for a new team to get up to speed quickly is buy an existing design package from the Kiwis or from one of the other teams, I guess?
Yeah, look, absolutely. I think if there's new teams out there, and you know, there's any of the teams that are open to sharing, you know, their design package or their information, I think that's a really fantastic way of sort of, you know, enabling some of these new teams to come to the table. Because it's, you know, as a startup team, to put a 30 plus design team together, you know, shore team, boat building team, and actually build a whole team. It's a monumental undertaking. And I think, like in Formula One or MotoGP or Dakar or any of these sort of, you know, technically based sort of other sports, there is the ability with some of those sports to buy components, for example. You know, there's engine suppliers can get, you know, get separate, or suspension suppliers in cars, or aerodynamic packages you can buy. So the America's Cup, very much I see it as, is very similar to that, where I think if other teams could do deals with other teams to buy, you know, if their strength was foil design, for example, why wouldn't you collaborate with another team whose strength was in rig design, and then you both raise the bar, and then ultimately you're wanting to sort of, you could be fighting it out together, a little bit like an Olympic training partner. If your Olympic training partner is, you're fighting it out for first and second, well, how cool is that? You know, you'd rather be doing that than fighting it out for, you know, 10th or 12th. So I think in the future, that to me is certainly a way of getting new teams, you know, to the table. And there's probably other ways as well, but certainly the design aspect is pretty daunting for, you know, for a lot of the newer teams. And even for, you know, Adams, for example, getting back on the table again, if they were to come back it's a big undertaking to put together a huge group, and we know that they have got a fantastic group of designers, but yeah, it's not easy to gain years of experience overnight. So that's where sometimes, you know, possibly buying some equipment that already is designed and engineered that you know is probably going to be pretty good could be a way of or part thereof of some teams getting into it. Maybe there's some teams that will decide to use half a package, or maybe they'll buy a rig package, for example, and not the whole package, and they'll work on putting it all together. But I think there's certainly different ways to skin the cat, so to speak. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there down the track.
Just a quick one. Would you bring the Cyclos back or replace them with batteries?
That's a really fantastic question. I know that's been sort of bantered around a lot, you know, over the last sort of few months. And I personally really enjoy the athleticism of the Cyclor side of things, whether it be cycling or grinding. I think there's something pure about it, and I think it has its place. You look at the way the AC40 sail, and everyone's just pushing buttons, and the batteries are doing everything, and the racing's really good, and the boats are cool, and everyone thinks that's great too. So I see a place for both. Luckily, it's not my decision, Justin, to make that call. It can be bantered around in the Team New Zealand office, and also the Challenger of Record, whoever that ends up being, I guess. That can be bantered around over the next sort of few months, and whatever the outcome will be, it will be the right call, because there'll be enough smart people all sitting around debating it that will make the right decision. So the armchair warriors, I'm sure, will have an opinion, but at the end of the day, some there'll be a decision made, and that'll be what it'll be.
Fantastic. The land speed record, I don't want to go through the whole story of it, because the documentary that you made with Leon Sefton is up on the web and available, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes. I can't recommend people to watch it enough. It's a fantastic short film is probably the best way of describing it. I just wanted to ask you, given all of your experience with sailing, how different was it to pilot that boat, that, are we calling it a boat, a car, at those sort of speeds? I mean, 224 kilometers an hour, I think, was the top speed. But what was that like?
It was actually quite a surreal feeling once we broken the record and you'd sort of stopped and packed up and gone home. You're like, wow, did that actually happen? And you know, it was one of those ones, like, we didn't just go from, you know, just rocking up and, you know, doing that sort of top speed. It was, you know, it was a sort of a series of workups over a long period of time. You know, you sort of go, you know, for our first couple of runs at the runway at Whenuapai in Auckland, you know, we got up to sort of 90 or 100 kilometres an hour, and you're like, oh, this is pretty exciting, and realising you weren't even half of where you needed to go, and you'd be tighter. You'd been towed up to speed, you know, at a huge rate of knots with a Toyota Land Cruiser. So, you know, that was, you know, from those baby steps to actually making it out to Lake Gairdner, and then having our first couple of runs where we, you know, we spun out, we had the wrong tires on, you know, and then it rained, and we just literally, you know, kept getting rained on, and the lake kept filling up with water. And it was actually really, really, you know, way more difficult than I ever thought it was going to be in that sense. But the driving side of things of the craft, once you actually got over 175, 180 kilometers an hour, that's when things started to get real. Like, up to there, you were sort of, it felt like you were just sort of in cruise mode. You know, you had a bit on for sure, but it was once you got over 180 kilometers an hour and you actually started to get towards 200 kilometers an hour, over 190 kilometers an hour, the craft almost got to the point where it felt like it started planing, or like if you're in a dinghy and you start sort of planing, it sort of felt like you got out of the hole and you were starting to plane, and you were really, really getting up and boogieing. And the craft was basically designed to actually slide across the surface at about 10 degrees. So best grip from the tires was actually at about a 10 degree slip angle is what we'd sort of modeled. And that was actually really, really accurate. So balancing the craft was sort of all about just achieving that 10 degree slip angle with the pod sort of just off the ground or just touching, with the front wheel basically steering straight. So you didn't want to have to hold any lock on one way or the other. Once we balanced the craft up and we sort of learned what was working, what wasn't, we started to get better and better in our performance. But the actual driving was a combination between all my years of sailing, car driving, go-karting, dune buggy driving, drifting cars around dirt roads where I grew up, you know, and flying model aeroplanes, because you're sort of flying the wing on its side. You're actually like literally flying the tailplane to control the power of the wing. So all that combined, I guess, knowledge and just things that I've done, you know, motorbike riding, just adjusting power and the slip angle. And, you know, we were going through grippy bits, slippery bits. The surface was just so changeable, even from run to run, you know, 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, you know, the surface would change in its grip, and you'd be, as you know, the day went on, or, you know, even the tide, the moon would actually be pulling the water up through the surface of the salt and then back down again. So depending on the day and depending where the moon was, the lake actually had a tide, which was like invisible. So it changed the moisture content and the grip coefficient. So it was just such an unknown feeling. And to get actually up to speed, and once you actually got fully up to speed and you were holding it sort of, you know, around about sort of 90 to 95 degrees true wind angle, you'd then pull the craft once you got to your sort of maximum terminal velocity, or you ran out of runway, which we were doing most of the time after about 7 kilometers of building speed, after doing a reverse run, you'd then pull into about a kilometer long bearaway. And where basically there you would actually use the centrifugal force or mass of the craft that wanted to keep going in a straight line, you'd actually bear away and basically completely unload the side load, if you like, off the tires. So they were just rolling across the ground in a straight line. And you'd actually be able to take on more power in the wing, because as you use the centrifugal force, the pod, in theory, started to become heavier. So you could actually, it's a bit like sort of, you know, doing a, you know, you stood on a big lever on your trapeze, or you could hike way off the boat. You're on this big pendulum. And so I'd actually squeeze with my foot on sort of an accelerator pedal, which was a hydraulic pump. I'd actually squeeze that on, which would pump the tailplane in, which would actually effectively fly the wing in tighter. So like pulling your main sheet on as you were bearing away at sort of 220 kilometers an hour, which would, if you squeezed it just a bit too far at that speed, you'd fly the pod and you'd have to ease and you'd crash down and you'd risk spinning the craft. And if you didn't squeeze it on enough, the pod wheel would be too loaded, so you wouldn't get your terminal velocity in the bearaway. So you had to squeeze on enough to neutralize the forces but keep the pod just flying. So it was a real sort of knife-edge balance. It was incredible. The load that would come on in the craft in that bearaway was absolutely incredible. You could actually feel the craft bending underneath where you were sitting, and your backside would basically get pressed down, and the skeg of the craft would actually carve a black line through the salt as the whole fuselage bent under the load. So, I mean, it literally would bend up to about 250 millimeters under full load. So when you were unloaded, the craft was, you know, quite off the ground, but when you were sailing, it would actually all compress and bend and press down. And some of the photos you've seen as the craft's been like going along, it's literally just compressed into the salt. So with twin rear wheels basically fully compressed, we'd done about 3 runs and we'd actually pretty much wear out a set of rear tires, which were taking about 90% of the side load. So yeah, it was an amazing experience, but yeah, can't believe it's sort of all been and gone.
Yeah, so what's next for that? Is that take that project, put it all away, send it to a museum somewhere?
I'm hoping it's going to be like a nice bottle of wine, Justin, that it'll just go in the cupboard for a while, and it'll just get better and better with age, and maybe one day we'll pull it out again if we need to. And if someone comes and knocks us off our perch, we'll probably have to try and pull it out again. But or it may never see the light of day again. Look, I'm not really 100% sure. It would be great to get out there and go a little bit quicker, because I know the craft has got more in it, but I think that's probably what every single person that says that's done a land speed or a water speed project, there's probably always more in the tank. But for now, it's really, you know, I'm really, really working as hard as I can personally on getting the next challenge, which is to break Paul Larson's 500 meter water speed sailing record. That's really what I'm working hard on. I've had a lot of chats with Paul He's given me his blessing to have a go at breaking his record, which is great. And I know the SP80 guys are also trying to break that, as are others. And, you know, it's a huge undertaking to break Paul's, you know, 65.45 knots on the final. I mean, that's fairly well ripping. And I know that's a unbelievably steep mountain to climb. And, you know, that for me is the challenge that I've had again since I was very, very young. And, you know, to have broken the land speed record, to be able to try and break the water speed sailing record and hold, you know, the two records concurrently, that'd be a pretty nice way to sign things off. Hopefully I can survive to tell the tale.
That would be amazing. That's I wasn't aware of that at all. That's I'm so happy to hear that you're going after that. I was just about to mention Paul Larson, and you know, I think he had when I spoke to him, he had a similar attitude to, if somebody knocks us off our perch, then maybe we'll get the boat out again and try and defend. So, wow, that's fantastic news.
I hope it does. No, look, it's a lifelong dream, and it's so hard to know when the right time in your life is to take on these challenges. I mean, they're not cheap. They're not easy. You know, Mother Nature plays a huge part. But I think for myself, looking to the future, I think the ability to sort of, I guess, showcase what we can do as a sport and what we can do in the future, you know, by breaking a speed record just powered by the wind, just powered by Mother Nature, for me, that sort of opens up a whole lot of thinking about what else can we do with wind power? Like, where does it lead to? What is the future of using the wind? What's the future of sailing? And that to me is sort of one of the catalysts, I guess, for doing it. It's like, well, you know, I've been getting blown along by the wind and pulled along by the wind for a long time, sailing little boats into bigger boats. And it's like, well, you know, where to from here? And I'd like to sort of think that, you know, in 15 or 20 or 30 years' time, you put an effort in a unique way to help shape the future of what, you know, wind-powered craft can be. And with what Paul did with Sail Rocket, I mean, that today, you know, from 2011, you know, 14 years later, it's still unbelievable to watch those videos and just how fast that's going and how fast Paul was going with his team and you know, it sends chills down your spine to watch those videos. But it also does, you know, with a lot of different, you know, records over the years. Like for me, you know, breaking records is, you know, it's so hard to do. And that's one thing that I've really become to realize more and more, that if records were easy to break, everyone would be doing it all the time. But they are so difficult. And that's what makes it just so hard. So look, it's a wonderful challenge, and I'm really hoping to sort of get that off the ground, so to speak. You know, there's been a little bit of initial work going on that over the last sort of few months, but I'm really hoping that over the next few months I'll be able to, you know, allocate some resource and some design, you know, personnel that I've worked with previously to be able to put that project together. And, you know, it won't be it's nothing like an America's Cup campaign. It's a small group of people that are very passionate about being involved and taking it on. And without those small group of people that are passionate as I am to take it on, you know, it simply just doesn't happen. So I'm just very fortunate to have you know, a great group of people that are equally as passionate as I am to try and knock it off. And I look forward to having a beer with Paul when it's done.
Yeah. So I guess you're keen to talk to potential sponsors, backers of this whole thing. It sounds like a fantastic way to showcase somebody's technology, some company's ability in this area.
Oh, look, if you know of anyone, Justin, I'm all ears. I certainly need some support, and it's you know, it's very unique, and it's very different, and it's not for everyone. So it is very difficult to find backing for it. But hopefully, there's some people or some companies out there that are sort of you know, crazy enough to sort of take it on. And I have been very fortunate in the past to have some fantastic, you know, private support and Team New Zealand support with the Land Speed project. So we'll see what happens down the track, but I certainly can't do it on my own, that's for sure.
Fantastic. Well, a plea from me and from all of the fans of these sort of projects, please document it on video. right from the beginning, right from the kitchen table planning, please make sure you've got somebody just filming some of the meetings, because when the documentary inevitably gets made, it makes such a difference that we're not joining it just before everything happens.
No, exactly, Leon, and many, many people have said that exact thing. You know, always try and capture as much as you possibly can, because it's actually the, you know, and previously I was like, I don't need cameras, don't need to worry about that, I just want to get it done. But after, you know, having been involved in sort of productions over the last sort of couple of years, it really does tell a story, and it actually creates value, and, you know, for sponsors and for the audience, and, you know, the storytelling aspect of, you know, documentaries and sporting events, whatever it may be, you know, that's really the value. And it's a shame when, you know, records get broken and, you know, hasn't been filmed, or, you know, the story hasn't been told properly. So, we'll definitely try and make sure we do a good job in the future. But, it's not without its challenges either.
Fantastic. Well, the very, very best of luck with that. Any way I can help, just let me know. I'm going to say thanks to you for being with us on the podcast today. It's been really, really great. And I know people will enjoy listening to it. Good luck with that project. And I hope we see you back commentating in the Cup, wherever and whenever that's going to be.
We'll see how we go. But I really appreciate it, Justin. Been fantastic to talk to you. And well done with all what you're doing as well.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. We will be back soon with another top name interview, but in the meantime, check out yachtracinglife.com for more great content from across the sailing world.